hammer.
I'm seeking representation.
The jaded lawyer with no respect for the law.
Innocent people can't afford me.
The truth stays with us.
Would you accept a client if you were constantly thinking, I don't want this person to touch me?
I have a case.
There's nothing to prove he did anything.
In this country,
you do not speak. Your job is just to sit there and look innocent.
Do you have any other questions for me, counselor?
I had a job in a defense plant. I could have taken a deferment.
Sir, I know the law, and I know my son is protected by those laws. They're framed in our Constitution.
Your Honor, I'd like to ask for a recess.
I'd like an answer to the question, Judge.
The court will wait for an answer.
I'm Dan Simrell. Welcome back to the continuation of the Joanne Curley case file here on The Hammer. We pick up with our story recounted by former Luzerne County District Attorney and former Luzerne County Judge Peter Paul Olszewski. At this point, the body of Bob Curley was exhumed and the casket is about to be opened. Let's find out what the prosecutors were up against. Are you there?
Sure, this is quite
a sight, right? This is quite a scene.
Oh, yeah, it's quite a sight. And by that time, I had done dozens and dozens of autopsies with our coroners, so that was nothing new. But in this case, it was new. Because in this case, when we opened the casket, the water had deteriorated Bob Curley's face and body so much that the skin, it was almost like soap. The stench was horrific. He was buried with a University of Notre Dame hat on, and that was there. And luckily, not all of his hair had fallen out prior to his being buried. So we were able to recover hair samples, and the fingernails were not cut during the initial autopsy, so we were able to recover fingernails and we were able to recover toenails. The question now was, were they contaminated by the water?
Right.
Those samples then went to Dr. Reeders. He took them to his laboratory in Willow Grove, and we waited. While we were waiting, again, there was no resolution to the case at this point. And then the call came from Dr. Reeders that he had completed his study. And Bob Curley wasn't poisoned once. He wasn't poisoned twice. He wasn't poisoned five times. He wasn't poisoned 10 times. Bob Curley received 11 different ingestions of thallium over a period of time that included A, while he was a patient inside the Wilkes-Barre General Hospital, and the final ingestions while he was a patient inside the Hershey Medical Center.
That is mind-numbing to think of that. So it's clearly not the coworkers. This was not a practical joke. This is something much more sinister.
Well, the whole practical joke theory was completely debunked at that point. The co-workers as suspects was completely debunked. It forever changed my opinion about the reliability of a polygraph examination. And we knew now that the person who murdered Bob Curley saw him while he was a patient and visited him while he was a patient, both at the General Hospital and the Hershey Medical Center. Obviously now the focus turns to the wife. This information was top secret. There was a very limited number of people who were given access to this information. So what we decided to do at that point was, let's give Joanne a polygraph. We had about all the information, all the interviews we could do with her. So if she turned on us, so be it. But we're going to give her a polygraph. We brought in the same polygraph examiner, best examiner, best equipment, gave her the examination, and she passed with flying colors.
Wow. So you know what's coming. You mentioned this. You have the information. You're pretty much loaded for bear. And you give her this polygraph test, and she aces it. Are you thinking, this woman is a sociopath? She is so cunning. What are you thinking at this point, other than the fact that clearly polygraph tests have some serious flaws?
Right. We knew, was it a possibility at that point that somebody other than Joanne Curley, a family member other than the wife, could have done this? Yes. That was a possibility. We knew that if it was her, she's a cold-blooded, hard-nosed, rotten killer. So what we had to do then was to formulate a game plan that is 100% the antithesis of the way you typically do a homicide investigation. And by that I mean our job now was to determine every live, living, breathing human being who potentially could have done this. Who were all the people who had access to Bob Curley shortly before he was admitted to the Wilkes-Barre General Hospital? Who had access to him in the Wilkes-Barre General Hospital? And who had access to him at the Hershey Medical Center?
So this is an overlapping Venn diagram. There are not going to be many people that overlap all of these locations.
Correct. And what we found at that point was that there was one person who had contact with him at all three locations. And that was Joanne Curley. The problem now was to exclude everybody else. So we went about that business and we did additional interviews to confirm that there was nobody who had access to him at both hospitals and on particular dates prior the early ingestions, when he was just getting ill. Who had access to him at that point? Who had access in the general? Who had access in Hershey? And through that process of elimination or exclusion, we knew that Joanne Curley was the killer.
And this is almost 5 years, or roughly 5 years,
correct,
after his death. You put all these pieces together.
Correct.
And then you charge her.
Oh, I didn't charge her yet.
Really? What happens before
her? The biggest problem here is the evidence that we had to charge her with had never before been entered or admitted in a trial in Pennsylvania. And if I arrested her and I then went to trial and the trial court refused to admit this evidence,
you're dead.
I'd have to cut her loose.
Right, right. And you've blown it. So you're being about as careful as you can be. You do not want this fish off the hook.
Correct.
So what do you do?
So what we did at that point was we consulted the family. When I say family, we mean Bob Curley's mother, sister, and brother. And we talked to them a little bit. I then convened a meeting at my home to make sure it was the most private place possible with all the investigators. We met all day. We talked about the case, the pros and cons of an arrest, and then we went around the table. We went around the table to each investigator, and there were about eight of us there, and I asked their position. Arrest or don't arrest? And we went all around the table until it got to me. And I was the last one. And it was a unanimous decision to make the arrest. So I authorized the arrest. I signed the documents that needed to be signed. And we picked her up and handcuffed her, and off we went. What we then did was, given that pathology and toxicology is the key to the case, given that I had the world's number one pathologist, I decided to also go out and hire the world's number two forensic pathologist for two purposes. One, so the defense couldn't. And two, I would use that person during testimony at the preliminary hearing and then not use him at the time of trial. So there would be no, I would save Dr. Bodden would not be cross-examined at the preliminary hearing. I would have a fresh witness at the time of trial. And the pathologist that I did call at the preliminary hearing would not be used at the trial. So I went to Pittsburgh and hired the forensic pathologist out of Allegheny County, who top shelf, top forensic pathologist, also a member of the Warren Commission with Dr. Bodden.
That's amazing. So you realize you're stacking this deck as much as you can, so that her defense is you just popping holes in her defense. Is that the theory? What you're doing here?
That's the theory that we're doing. But again, the problem, the unknown. Although I had evidence, I had the pathologists, I had the investigators, was the trial judge, and that was President Judge Patrick Toole, former DA of Luzerne County, would he admit the evidence? And even if he did, and even if we got a conviction, would the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania uphold the conviction based upon that evidence? So off we went. We went through the preliminary hearing. We were very successful. It was a two-day preliminary hearing. The charges went forward. I then filed the paperwork that I needed to ask for the death penalty in the case. We had multiple aggravating circumstances, so it was going to be clearly a first-degree prosecution. The defense, as we anticipated, then filed pretrial motions challenging the reliability of the segmental analysis, and it set the stage for what's called a FRY hearing, where we would have to establish the reliability, the sufficient reliability of that testing to allow the court to admit it. I flew to San Antonio, Texas, and I, with a couple of investigators, and talked to the only other toxicologist who participated in that one trial in the country where it was admitted, and engaged him for the purpose of testifying to the reliability of this analysis. Got him on board. And as we were preparing for the Frye hearing, defense counsel made an appointment to see me. And Frank Nacido, honorable lawyer, very capable lawyer, came to see me and acknowledged that both sides had issues, both sides had problems. What I consider a guilty plea to murder of the third degree and a statutory maximum sentence of 10 to 20 years.
Well, that's a big decision, knowing that she's a conniving, horrible. I would go so far as to call her a rat if it wasn't for the rat poison.
She's no good.
Yeah.
She was no good, dirty, rotten. We also determined that her motivation for this was a $300,000 life insurance policy on Bob's life.
Well, that's a pretty big nugget that you might have skipped over earlier. So the motivation was clearly there.
Motivation
means clearly there.
Right.
So what happens with the plea?
I wanted to reject it out of hand. The investigators were not so keen on rejecting it. So what we did is we had the family, the mother, the two son and daughter, had engaged counsel to sue Wilkes University about the thallium, and and had engaged counsel and Joanne had secured counsel to get the life insurance proceeds. So what we did was we had a family meeting with the mother, daughter, brother, and their counsel. I disclosed to them the offer and asked what they wanted to do as the victims of the case.
At this point, is the mother still alive?
She was.
Mary was still alive.
She was. She
but
was.
The brother and sister, Susan and David, they're ripe, right? They are
right
really
there, pumped
right
up
there.
And they were pretty deferential to Mom.
Yeah.
And Mom, as the matriarch of the family, so to speak, said, well, why did she do all these things? And I told her we didn't have an answer to that. We could suggest it's the money, but why she did it. They ultimately said to me, if she would agree to an interview and answer each and every one of your questions about how, when, where, and why, and you thought that she was being sufficiently honest with those answers, we would want you to take the plea to third degree murder.
So how did that interview go?
So we did the interview, and I personally interviewed her. And the investigators were in the room, and it was taped, and she fully admitted that it was rat poison that she had used, that she put it in his iced tea. She said she poisoned him multiple times before he had any symptoms that sent him to the Wilkes-Barre General Hospital. She couldn't believe that he was living, and admitted that she poisoned him while a patient in the General Hospital.
You're conducting this interview with this crazy woman. Are you thinking, I am, and she aced the polygraph test. You have this in the back of your mind, right? So are you thinking, I am talking to the incarnation of evil right here.
Right. But she didn't know everything that we knew. We didn't disclose all that yet.
Okay. So she's still...
She had some... They had a lot of it because they were preparing for the Fry test.
Sure.
So we knew that she was being candid. She said that in both hospitals, she admitted to poisoning him at Hershey. She admitted that the last poisoning was a large amount of thallium that he wanted... he wanted a Coke from McDonald's. So she went to McDonald's and got him a glass of Coke with a straw and put the thallium in that, and that he drank that in front of her at the Hershey Medical Center.
It's almost hard to believe that, you know, at this point she's probably thinking, I don't want the death penalty, I guess, right?
Right.
So after the interview, are you satisfied that she was honest?
The investigators were all satisfied.
How does the family participate in this interview?
They did not participate.
But I mean, they hear it later. They listen to, or you told
we
them.
We told them.
They didn't listen to her speaking.
No.
Yeah, one of the interesting
things too is before we agreed to go forward with that interview, the family asked us to do it. The family said, "We want you to take the plea." But it wasn't the family's decision. It was my decision. I convened a second meeting at my house. And this discussion was, do we take the plea? And we went around the table. And every single person around the table said, take the plea. And it came to me. And I said, I don't want to take the plea.
Wow.
And it was 8-1.
Wow.
And then we spent more hours. And ultimately, then I agreed.
So it had to be a unanimous.
I wanted it to be.
Well, that makes sense. I'm going to fast forward a little bit here to December of 2016. It's Cambridge Springs, which is out by Erie, and Joanne Curley is being released from a 20-year sentence in prison, and she's headed back to Luzerne County. No one knows exactly where she's going to live, but she's headed back home. She's 53 now, 53 years old. She's coming back. In an interview with the Times Leader, they actually interviewed Susan and David, the brother and sister, and they said that they felt a sense of accomplishment that they, along with their late mother Mary, were able to keep Joanne in prison for her entire sentence, the full 20 years. Correct. However, Susan said, we still don't feel that she paid her debt to society, that she really got what she deserved, even though it was 20 years in prison. How do you feel?
Well, when Susan Hooper was asked by me, did she agree to take the plea, before I took it, Susan Hooper was unanimous with her brother and her mother to take the plea. So when Susan Hooper says what she said in that newspaper article, it means very little to me.
Right, right. And at the time, they may have been thinking, we'll take 20 years over the possibility of this case slipping through our fingers because of the reliability of this test.
It was two unknowns that presented the real hurdle. A, would the trial judge admit the evidence? And B, even if the trial judge admitted the evidence, would the jury believe that with the fingernails and the hair submerged in water for several years, and that testing on those kind of contaminated samples had never been done before?
Right, right.
Would the jury buy that? And if the jury said no and found her not guilty, Joanne Curley could have conducted a press conference on the steps of the Luzerne County Courthouse and told everybody that she's guilty and she beat the system.
And double jeopardy would
prevent us from making a rearrest.
So it was a calculated decision to get her to pay in some way.
It was one of those decisions where half a loaf is better than a full loaf.
Right, right.
Or taking a chance at getting a full loaf.
Had this gone all the way through trial, what do you think a jury, if the jury was exposed or had heard of the interview that you did with her where she answers all these questions, what do you think the outcome would have been? Like the death penalty?
Right. Well, that never would have happened, right? That never would have happened. I mean, I think the question of
test results were allowed.
If the jury found her guilty of first degree murder, I would believe that I would have had the ability to convince them that the torture that she submitted him to, the multiple ingestions, the ingestions as late as the Hershey Medical Center, and the documented pain beyond comprehension for a lengthy period of time, I believe that we would have been successful with the death penalty. But at the same time, had we not been successful in that case, I think that public scrutiny and the public feeling of her getting away with murder would have been worse.
Hmm. So Joanne and Bobby were married in September of 1990, and she starts poisoning him 2 months into their wedding, 2 months into their married life. So I think intent and that cruelty would have definitely held up. And the sister, Susan, and brother David, and mother Mary all said, and everyone who knew Bobby said, this was a happy-go-lucky guy who was murdered simply for no reason at all.
It was a pointless, senseless murder for $300,000. It was like Judas Iscariot selling out the Lord for a couple pieces of silver. Mm-hmm. It was ridiculous. She's a cold-blooded, no good, dirty, rotten murderer. That's what she is. And she's going to have that with her, not only in this lifetime, but that's going to remain with her in the next lifetime.
Mm. So in summary, do you feel vindicated that her case at least was solved and that some form of justice was served, that the hammer came down on the right side of the law this time.
I truly believe that when faced with a decision of such magnitude, with so much emotion was involved, where there was so much intrigue, and where the family, the real victims, the family of Bob Curley asked me, told me to take the plea to third degree murder, as much as I wanted to pursue a first degree murder and death penalty conviction, I could sleep with myself at night knowing that I made the right decision.
Well, that's certainly the right answer. And I just want to say thank you, Peter Polyshevsky, for taking the time to talk to us today about this absolutely fascinating case. And I can't wait to talk to you about the next one. Thank you very much for your time, and we'll talk to you all again soon on the next episode of The Hammer. And until then, stay out of trouble.